We have to think about what New Zealand was like in 1870 when he launches this public works scheme. The two islands, really, the North and South Island, are like two separate countries. Gold rushes and pastoral farming had made the South Island rich. It attracted tens of thousands of settlers there, helped by the fact that relatively few Maori lived there, and by the 1860s, almost the whole South Island was in Pākehā hands. But by 1870, the gold boom's over, and pastoralism in the South Island, which at this stage is wool and wheat, is not really a major export earner. This was before refrigerated meat was developed in the 1880s, refrigerated meat exports. The North Island is quite a different picture. The wars are basically over, but there's a huge amount of uncertainty still, and Maori still dominate most of the North Island. And this is a map of Maori land. This is from NZ History Net, map of Maori land of 1860, and you can see at this point the South Island would be entirely white. It is, rather than dark blue, it is, as it says there, all but, well, 99% of the South Island had been purchased by the Crown and New Zealand Company by 1865. Now, if we go to 1870, there's not actually a map for 1870, but apart from confiscations which followed the wars in Waikato, Taranaki, and Bay of Plenty, and some other relatively small purchases, the map still looks pretty much the same in 1870, a complete contrast to the South Island. So in the North Island, what we're really looking at is a maritime frontier. The European settlements are coastal cities, and they're mainly linked by shipping, sailing ships, small steamships. Over land, there are tracks which have been hacked through the bush, cross mountains, cross rivers. Drowning, especially in rivers, is actually the main killer of people. And also traveling by ship can be dangerous and is also generally uncomfortable and very slow. Just one story to illustrate this. In 1854, when New Zealand's first parliament met in Auckland, and politicians who had been elected the previous year came from all over the country to meet in the parliament. They had a little steamship. It was the first steamship in New Zealand on the New Zealand coast, and that collected politicians from Littleton and Nelson and Wellington and New Plymouth, and took them to Onehunga in the Mangere Harbour. And how long is that going to take, that trip from Littleton to Auckland? It takes them 12 days. But they're the lucky ones, because the MPs from Otago decided to go on a sailing ship, and it took them 2 months to get to Auckland, and because the winds were not favourable. And when they came back from Auckland, they decided to sail via Sydney because it was quicker. So they went Auckland, Sydney, Dunedin. So you can see there would be a desire for improved transport links. another really important factor this time, the provincial governments, as I mentioned. While New Zealand had a central government, it had a system of provincial governments that had been established in the 1850s. And given the isolation I just talked about, that, of course, that makes perfect sense. But each province wanted to improve their own infrastructure, their own transport links, their own economies, but they didn't want to pay for anyone else's. And so right from the start, you know, things like transport, politics, parochialism just go hand in hand. Canterbury and Otago were the only provinces that had really achieved a lot in the 1860s in the way of infrastructure. Vogel, when he comes into politics in Otago, is actually initially a South Island separatist, if not an Otago separatist. But he doesn't want South Island provinces paying for the wars in the North Island. But he later changes his mind and actually becomes probably the single key figure in abolishing the provinces. Now, provincial governments have built New Zealand's first railways. This is the first one at Ferrymead in Christchurch in 1863. This is a painting of the opening ceremony. And Southland had built a railway in 1864. They're very small scale, very primitive, even by the standards later in the 19th century in New Zealand. But even that virtually bankrupted Southland province. Canterbury was a bit more successful. But in 1870, New Zealand's got 46 miles, that's 74 kilometres of railway. And all of it is in Canterbury and Southland. The North Island's got no railways at all. The northern provinces couldn't afford to build railways. They also, despite the wars, there was Maori land, which was an obstacle to building railways. So they were looking to central government to deliver this promise of railway and riches that it would promise. In 1869, Vogel becomes colonial treasurer. This is one of the statements he made in Parliament. New Zealand is a peculiar country. You cannot get over its geographical configuration. You cannot bring together the two ends nearer than they are. There will always be a certain amount of isolation in different parts until the iron horse, common phrase for the railway, runs through the two islands. And at this stage, when there's 70 kilometres of railway, it's a pretty, you know, sort of bold statement to try and build the implication of building a national railway network. So in June 1870, Vogel unveils this plan in Parliament, the most ambitious public works and immigration program in New Zealand's history. It was to be funded by massive borrowing in London, in the London money markets, £10 million by 1876. And the plan includes telegraphs, which are another really important invention being developed at the same time as railways, and often parallel with each other, and the telegraph lines were built alongside railways. Roads, public buildings, better port facilities, and assisted immigration, that is, government-subsidised passages for people to come from Britain. But at the heart of it was his promise to build more than 1,000 miles of railways in 9 years. So what was the government trying to do? Partly to revitalise economy, which was war-weary from the 1860s. The gold boom was over and the economy was stagnating. But it was a higher ambition, and that was to reignite what they saw as the New Zealand's colonisation project. And Premier William Fox calls it, to quote, to re-illume that sacred flame, which is a very highfalutin way of putting it. Now, to the Pākehā settlers, much of the North Island, that's that dark blue section that we saw on the map before, was a wilderness, what they saw as a wilderness of bush, Māori land, which was usually termed wasteland, and potential rebellion. Very recently, the clashes with the warrior prophets Te Tokiwara and Te Kauti, this is in the late 1869, had forced settlers to flee from homesteads in the countryside to the safety of coastal towns. So instead of war, Vogel's plan is partly to bring immigration, roads and railways into that area and to lead a peaceful conquest of that Māori heartland of the North Island. So the rapid and cheap acquisition of Māori land is a real cornerstone of this policy. And in effect, that is going to be the thing that's going to pay for the policy. So there was an idea that jobs on that Māori would be able to work on jobs building railways and roads. It would help integrate them into the European economy. The influx of settlers into the areas that are opened up by better infrastructure is going to swamp the local Māori population. And 2 decades later, when he was in the UK in retirement in 1893, Vogel made this statement. The public works policy seemed to the government the sole alternative to a war of extermination with the natives, which is fighting talk. But looking back to 1870, I mean, that may have been the case that politicians were contemplating.